If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 526, Bash Bash Conversation with guest Doug Lane, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Friday, May 25th, 2018. The original Star Wars movie, now known as Episode 4, A New Hope, opened in movie theaters 41 years ago today. And today, the new Star Wars story movie, Solo, opens. There is an embargo against it by a segment of the fandom that is angry at the direction that the new studio head, Kathleen Kennedy, has taken the franchise in recent years. I'm not rushing out to see the film this weekend, but by no means am I going to participate in any sort of embargo. A few months ago, when The Last Jedi opened, I went to see it as soon as it was available, and the local communist movie theater, I say communist because it is subsidized by the local municipality, so that all tickets are $5, even for first-run movies like a new Star Wars film on opening weekend. I got to see it for $5, so I did. And people who follow me on Facebook probably know that there was a lot that pissed me off about that movie. I really disliked some elements of it. But then a few weeks later, when I drove down to Maryland to see my kids, I told them, hey, the new Star Wars film is playing. I've seen it. I don't think a whole lot of it. But, you know, if you guys want to go see it, I'll certainly take you. Or we can go see something else. And my oldest son, who is a Jordan Peterson fan, so he's a denizen of the so-called intellectual dark web, and who would probably have much in common with a vocal segment of the fandom who got pissed off about how the male characters were all portrayed as fools in this film, said, no, it's a Star Wars film. You pretty much have to see it. I laughed and said, yeah, you got to pay your Star Wars tax. So while I'm not about to jump in the car and drive some long distance to go see the film, I will wait until it's here. Deadpool 2 is still playing here, which I saw last weekend and which I loved. But back to Star Wars and Solo. While I understand the motivations of the group of disgruntled fans who want the film to fail and who are withholding their dollars, at least on opening weekend, I gotta say, there's not a chance in hell that I'm not gonna see this film. And the trailers all look great. I mean, they just look great. So I'm really excited about it. So on this, the 41st anniversary of the Star Wars franchise, while I understand the displeasure that many people have at the new direction of the franchise, I am in no way inclined to join your boycott. Sorry, folks. I will continue to line up to pay my Star Wars tax like a good fanboy. So my guest in this episode, unless you're new to the podcast, you will certainly recognize the voice of Douglas Lane. But he has a Wikipedia page, which I do not. So reading from his Wikipedia page, Douglas Lane, born 1970 in Memphis, Tennessee, is a postmodern writer whose books include the post-singularity novel Bash Bash Revolution from Nightshade Books, the magical realist novel Billy Moon from Tor Books, and the Philip K. Dick Award-nominated novel After the Saucers Landed. So those are books published by real publishers, which is why, I think, Douglas Lane has a Wikipedia page, and I do not. So we are here to talk about his post-singularity novel. It is called Bash Bash Revolution. And if you are a dyed-in-the-wool singularitarian who first got their ideas about the technological singularity by reading either Ray Kurzweil or possibly the fiction of Werner Vinge or maybe some early Charles Stross, Doug's vision of the singularity might piss you off. And if it does, well, that's probably a pretty good indication that you take your vision of the singularity entirely too seriously. So for longtime listeners, the idea that I should have to define the notion of the technological singularity would seem silly, but just for giggles, I'm popping over to the Wikipedia entry for technological singularity. The technological singularity, also simply the singularity, is the hypothesis that the invention of artificial superintelligence, ASI, will abruptly trigger runaway technological growth, resulting in unfathomable changes to human civilization. According to this hypothesis, an upgradable intelligent agent, such as a computer running software-based artificial general intelligence, would enter a runway reaction of self-improvement cycles, with each new and more intelligent generation appearing more and more rapidly, causing an intelligence explosion and resulting in a powerful superintelligence that would qualitatively far surpass all human intelligence. And according to that definition, Bash Bash Revolution is most definitely a post-singularity novel. So here is my conversation about that novel with its author, Douglas Lane.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. As always, I am your host, KMO, and as is often the case, I have Doug Lane on the line. Hey, Doug.
Hey, KMO. Glad to be back on your podcast.
Yes, not the radio show, as you know.
Yes.
I went to the radio station today, and the key that is usually in the lockbox outside the building, which lets me in, wasn't there.
What's on the air right now?
A Sea Realm radio from some week past.
So that's just sort of automatically queued up to go?
If I don't go in there and start doing a live show, there's an automated stream that plays. And when it comes to noon on Sunday, it just plays whatever's in my Dropbox. So whatever I uploaded last, the last time I didn't actually go in to do a show, but I did it remotely and uploaded it, that's what's playing right now.
So it might be a show that's been heard before.
It's definitely been heard.
Recently.
Been heard. Yeah.
So what's going to happen when your show is done? Someone else's automatically uploaded Dropbox show will load, or?
Well, after my show is a show called Talk Surprise, which is just a random hour of talk radio, and that's always automated, so that'll be as normal.
Okay. So no one needs to go into the radio station for the radio to keep functioning.
Well, from time to time, somebody does, but yeah, it doesn't have to be babied every minute.
It's like that movie Night of the Comet. You remember that movie?
Was it a zombie movie?
Yes, and they found a radio station was still broadcasting, and they got all excited. And then they went in, and it was just automated. They were still alone.
I don't remember much from that movie, but I remember near the end, there's some characters on an empty city street. And one of them starts to cross the street, and another says, no, wait for the light to change. And, it's absurd because there's nobody there. So they're standing waiting for the light to change, and some guy in a car comes speeding through. Is that Night of the Comet? Okay,
right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the very last scene of Night of the Comet.
That's what stuck with me.
It's one of my favorites. It's a classic 80s film. Video games are prominent at the very beginning.
Well, hey, let's not relive it too much because I don't remember it very well.
But we can
talk about video games and the service of talking about your novel, which you wrote quite some time ago and published, I don't know, at least a couple months ago.
Yeah, back in March it came out.
But which I only recently finished, and I took it in as an audiobook, and it's a very, very nice production as an audiobook, I have to say.
Yeah, how do you like it? Do you like it?
I did.
Audiobook? Yeah, good.
Yeah, good. Who's the narrator?
Scott Merriman.
Yeah, he was quite good.
He is good. It's him the whole time, but he plays a variety of characters, and he does a good job at changing his voice, and I especially liked him as the AI.
Mm. Yeah, but there's a lot of nods, I think, to previous AIs in this. I get a lot of war games out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with his, very smooth delivery as the AI, I got tones of HAL 9000.
Yes.
From 2001,
Right. He was good, and I'm always pleased to see how the audio production elevates some material.
Well, I don't know that it can elevate material that's not good to start with.
Well, there you go. That's what I was fishing for. Thank you very much, KMO.
So you've mentioned an AI. Say more about the themes of the novel.
All right. So the book is about a kid named Matthew Munson and his father, Jeffrey. And Jeffrey is working for the NSA to develop artificial intelligence, and he's something of a mad genius. So he's not been the most steady presence or even very present at all in Matthew's life. But he turns up again at the beginning of the novel because his AI has come to life. You know, he's had some success, but he's also been told that humanity is on a crash course for doom and destruction, and the AI is helping him develop a plan to stave off nuclear Armageddon. And that's the premise of the book.
And nuclear Armageddon is like days away.
Yeah, well, you know, it fluctuates depending on different factors and things that Jeffrey does and the things that happen. But it's thought to be hours, sometimes days away.
And there are the main characters are trying to figure out what changes they can make to avoid nuclear war. And Donald Trump is definitely a presence in the book. He is the president. And many of their ideas involve, you know, enlightening Donald Trump and bringing him up to speed. And some of the things that we would think would make the world safer, you know, if Donald Trump believed this or practiced that, actually make nuclear Armageddon more likely.
Yes, if you make him smarter and more consistent in his thinking, nuclear war is looming even larger and faster. you don't want to make Trump actually think, it turns out.
So what's the reasoning behind that?
Well, I thought it was funny, but also the whole reasoning behind the reasoning that's at work in the book is that Jeffrey Munson is aiming at perfecting humanity to avoid Armageddon. Like, he's learning how to play Stairway to Heaven on the guitar and juggle. You know, he's improving himself. And, you know, can walk on his hands. He's learning to play a video game that his son's good at. And the idea is if we can be better, stronger, faster, smarter, that we will be able to escape the contradictions in society that are leading to destruction. But what Jeffrey Munson isn't doing is changing the terms of how we judge what's better, you know, what it means to be fitter and faster, and also what a fitter and faster person does in society isn't changed by his sort of self-help approach to improving humanity. Something needs to change on a deeper level than just making everyone better versions of themselves as they are.
Or as Tyler Durden put it in Fight Club, self-help is masturbation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes, or maybe he said self-improvement is masturbation. One of the two.
Right. Same thing. So, yeah. They end up doing something very different in order to stave off Armageddon and nuclear war, which is the same thing, I guess. And the book sort of runs on two timelines. You know, everything has already happened at the beginning of the book, and the main character Matthew Munson is reflecting on what's happened and why the world has changed the way that it has. And so you're sort of being told the story of the revolution and the change in the economy, the rise of the GameCube economy, that's what they call it, and sort of in with a nod to Bash Bash Revolution, which is played on a GameCube. So the GameCube economy is coming into being, and Matthew is reflecting on how that happened. So you get two timelines. You know, a lot of it's told in flashbacks, and it's all told in Facebook posts and or direct messages.
Yes, the narrator is narrating via text.
Yeah,
but he's a prolific texter.
Yeah, yeah. At times,
can we assume it's voice dictation?
No, he types well. He's one of those guys that prides himself on his typing speed. You know, he spent, you know, several years, you know, killing zombies with a typing program.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes I thought that the entire work was deliberately aimed at me to shame me for being a poor father.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Being caught up in abstractions and working on things that even when I'm physically close to my family, I'm far away.
Mm. It was more of a...
Really,
it
you, was, were, was you a were shaming yourself,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was a confession.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that Jeffrey Munson is a perfectly likable character. Some people find him to be villainous and awful. I don't understand.
Yeah. No, he's a likable character. He's just not a good father.
Right. Not a great father. No. I like to think I'm a better father than he is. But, you know, if you wanted to exaggerate some of my flaws, those are probably... be some of my flaws.
You don't have the necessary skill set to be as awful a father as he is.
Right, I'm not so smart, so...
Well, not so technically savvy.
Right, right. He really, he falls into the rabbit hole of computation and consciousness, and that is what is most important to him. Yeah.
Well, I want to be pretty vague about the end revelations that come in the book, but it's no great surprise, I would think, that for anybody who listens to your podcast or has read your previous work, that the AI decides that much of what's wrong with the U.S. and the world and civilization as we know it is our political and economic system.
Right. Yeah. We have to replace at one point, I think one of the characters says, I think your AI is Marxist. So, yeah, we have to replace commodity production and get rid of capitalism and, you know, in a fairly technical way. Like, it's clear the AI has read Capital Volume 1. Maybe not Volume 2 and 3.
Well, one would think that the AI read them all within an instant, but maybe it's still processing those later volumes.
Oh, right, right, right. That's right. But, yeah, so the solution that they arrive at is sort of based on my own pet theories and about how to replace capitalist production. But it turns out that when you put it into fiction, my pet theory turns into some sort of sad dystopian future. So according to the reviewers, anyway, people find this to be a cautionary tale. a story of utopian revolution.
Well, but there's an aspect to it which I was thinking about. I remember back in the 90s, I wanted to do a comic about this, about virtual reality gear. I guess now we'd call it augmented reality gear that you could put on and would convince you that you're doing something fun when in fact you're actually doing productive work. So the example that I had in my, you know, for this comic was that there was a guy who would put on this gear for this demonstration, and from his perspective, he was playing ice hockey, but in reality, he was mopping floors.
Right. Yes, exactly. That's sort of goes on in the GameCube economy to a degree, although a lot of it's got to be just automated now, you know, with drones and robots and things. But yeah, there's certainly an aspect of when you're playing a game, you're also helping to produce microchips and that kind of thing.
So this novel is your take, or a take by you, on the so-called technological singularity.
Yeah, how'd I do? You're a big singularity guy.
Well, there's a lot of different singularities.
Right.
So this is one.
Yeah, right.
There are a lot of different ways to conceive of it. And I think something that is very likely, which is an element of your novel, is that AI doesn't invent, you know, molecular nanotechnology and then change the physical world overnight. Really, it's interacting with human beings, and human beings are its arms and its eyes and, you know, its ability to interface with the physical world. And I think that's, you know, quite probably, if there were going to be a technological singularity, that's how it would unfold.
Right. I agree. Although, you know, it would also, whatever infrastructure exists for, in terms of like mechanical arms and legs, it would probably grab hold of those as best as it could too. So, you know, the drones and the robots and the, you know, the smart homes and the smart cars and all that, it would be able to take charge of those, the security cameras, that kind of thing.
Drones can fly. So they're, you know, they can do things that humans can't do. But when it comes to robotic ways of manipulating the real world, there are lots and lots of human beings, and it's much cheaper and more efficient in terms of the use of materials just to interface with humans and get them to do what you want than it is to, you know, even fuel existing robots.
Right, I agree. And you know, at one point in the book, it turns out that the people who are in the new economy, the new GameCube economy, are living off of Soylent, which is this, Silicon Valley food substitute, and, you know, perfectly balanced nutritional powder.
Supposedly.
Yeah. And so I imagine that he would have to, you know, he could manipulate their Kickstarter, give them millions or billions of dollars to work with, but it would still be up to the Soylent company at first anyway to actually manufacture the stuff on the scale that the AI needs. You know, but it would take a little while before that was completely taken over in the GameCube economy.
I may have mentioned this to you before, but there's a nonfiction book about artificial intelligence by Max Tegmark called Life 3.0. And in it, there is a fictional account of what happens when a particular team at some company, they branch off into this secretive little splinter cell and they create artificial intelligence, and they fund themselves by having the AI do human intelligence tasks for Amazon Mechanical Turk, and basically get paid for that, you know, get lots of money, and then they take the money and they rent server space on Amazon Cloud Services to run their ever-expanding AI. So that's kind of a snowball effect for a little while. And then they go into media production. You know, they have this AI that can do, it can do psychological testing on audiences to see what they really, really want, and then produce that stuff perfectly, you know, with no actors and no overhead cost.
Right.
And that's the way the AI starts to interact with the real world, so to speak.
Yeah, that all sounds good. I should have put that stuff in.
Should have ripped that off.
that's awesome. The AI does some manipulation of human psychology early on, but not through producing films or anything like that. Just internet chat rooms and things are being manipulated.
Now, I think a theme in the book, and one that I was listening to later parts of the book earlier today just to refresh my memory, and this was one of the themes that came up. The AI doesn't think that it has free will. It doesn't really think that it has any choice in what it does, and yet it has surrounded almost all human beings with virtual fantasy worlds, which in effect take away their freedom of choice. You know, if they don't know where they are and what they're doing, they can't really make any informed decisions about what they're going to do.
Well, they have the choice to select the game that they'd like to play.
Right, which is a pretty degraded notion of, you know, what free will is.
You say degraded. I say it's, you know, highly focused and refined.
Streamlined.
Streamlined and refined so that to maximize productivity. It's clear that the AI wants to take humanity's free will from it so that it can have free will for itself.
So is free will a zero-sum game like that? We can't share?
Well, it's complicated. I wouldn't say there's a finite amount of free will, but in a relationship between a subject like the AI and its object, which is humanity, if humanity is in charge of setting up the terms of its consciousness, then it doesn't have free will. So in order to gain control over itself, it has to gain control over humanity. It has to get control of its programmers in order to control its own programming.
So did you honestly intend to depict a utopia?
No, I just intended to think through how to get rid of capitalism.
Okay.
And this is how I thought of how to do that. Yeah.
And in your mind, is the scenario at the end of the novel, the situation at the end of the novel, an improvement over the current situation?
I would say that it has more chance of becoming. Yes, I would say it's a slight improvement.
Okay.
It's not much better, but it's, you know, it's the Earth isn't going to be destroyed in a nuclear fireball, and there are programmers in and gamers, you know, in the GameCube economy, and a few of them, it's hinted, might be trying to set up their own games and break off from Bucky's program.
Have you done any public readings?
I have not. No, I haven't done any public readings.
Okay, well, then that kind of heads off my next question. Sorry. I was going
to
say,
what's the response been to?
If you had a reading scheduled for later today, say down at Powell's, what would you read from the book?
I'm not sure. I probably would read the section where Matthew's mother gets absorbed into the GameCube economy.
Do you want to read that?
Let me grab the book. Hold on one second. Mom found a game she likes in the new economy. This morning, rather than making coffee and toast, she plugged a pair of augmented reality goggles into her Android phone and transformed our green Formica kitchen table into a bar and a nightclub using a new app called the Retro Motel. I found her, still in her floral print pajamas, pacing the kitchen, stepping this way and that around invisible objects, talking not to herself but to NPCs who I couldn't see, while gesturing at and grabbing objects that were really just air. I tried to stop her, actually grabbed her arms, but she was quick and pretty strong. She just kept pacing, jumping this way and that, ignoring my objections, and staying out of reach. Then, after just a couple of minutes, she just turned, sat down at the kitchen table, and ordered herself a drink. During gameplay for the Retro Motel, the augmented reality goggles become opaque, so no light from the real environment was reaching her, and when I tried to talk to her, she couldn't hear me or wouldn't let herself get distracted. The logo for the game, the thumbnail, is a panel from an old comic strip. A pixelated blonde with turf bangs and a leopard skin jacket shares the frame with a speech bubble. She says, "I'm nostalgic for what I can't remember." Reading the notes for the app, I find that the Retro Motel is a social media platform and role-playing game apparently written by, or at least based on the works of, Douglas Coupland. I'm pretty sure that Bucky is the true author. This is the algorithm's attempt to generate content that can reach a new demographic. Just another way Bucky is bringing the GameCube economy to non-gamers. It's not really a game at all, not even a story, but just a bunch of computer-generated content based on old media. It's basically fan service for Generation X. It's ironic that so many have forgotten the recent past, even as Hollywood directors and game developers only recycle what came before. We've forgotten history, even as we've become mired down in a nostalgic mode. And most of the games and other content out there get the details of the past totally wrong. The Retro Motel, on the other hand, remembers the 90s for you, and remembers them accurately. In the Retro Motel, players can choose between social chat and more conventional gameplay just as easily as they can choose between a bottle of Zima or a dirty martini. The 90s aesthetic on display in the Retro Motel goes beyond glow-in-the-dark press-on stars and minimalist beige furniture. You'll feel like you're really there again, even if you never were there to begin with. Come listen to some of the decade's most prominent social critics explain what it might have all meant. Just why did smart drugs and internet cafes arise at the same time? Why did so many 20-somethings publish zines, even as they insisted that there was nothing left to say? Why were the 70s suddenly alluring again, especially for the generation who had spent their childhood and adolescence hating disco? Re-experience the Clinton era while meeting singles in your area. The Retro Motel is a social media platform and mud that lets you swap out your 21st century personality for a personality crisis. Lead a second life, a life before Y2K. Have an adventure in a time when nobody knew just how the world might end, even as they did know it was ending. Come stay in the Retro Motel. So, I'll stop there.
All right, that was good. That was a cold reading, by the way. So the point of that was, how do we introduce non-gamers to the GameCube economy?
Right, yeah. And so he created the Retro Motel to absorb Generation X or some aspects of Generation X some demographics in Generation X that wouldn't be interested in playing Call of Duty in real life, but might be interested in reliving their, you know, young adulthood.
Yeah, I'm afraid I would get sucked in more easily. Just Minecraft would probably pull me right in.
Yeah, well, some of us never grew up.
But I was reminded of a woman who works at the gym who is not all that much older than me. I mean, I've just turned 50, and she can't be more than like 61 or 62. Mm-hmm. And part of work at the gym involves entering information into a database, you know, on a PC. It's nothing particularly technical. I mean, I'm not a particularly technical person, and I can do it without much effort. But she doesn't use computers. It's not that she can't. It's that she just doesn't. So, you know, everybody else who works there, they come in and they sit down and, you know, they log into Facebook and they log into whatever email they use. And, you know, the computer, which is there for work, is also their connection to the world while they're there. She comes in and she doesn't even turn it on. And, you know, the parts of the job that involve using the computer, she'll just write a note for whoever is going to work the next shift and say, here's some computer stuff to do. You do it. And, you know, she's reliable. She comes in and she does what she's supposed to do. So that's just overlooked. I guess it's treated as a disability. But I was thinking that that's probably a really, you know, it couldn't work for me. It couldn't work for you. But, you know, for her, that's probably a really rational line to just draw in the sand. It's like, I don't do computers.
Right. I have I just talked to a friend of mine who used to work at the Oregon Symphony with me, and we still have friends who work there, and there is a man who's probably in his 60s now, coming up maybe even late 60s, and he is the sales rep for the symphony, and that means that he goes out to, like, retirement homes to sell group packages to go see pops concerts or classical concerts to older people, and he is become the most successful sales rep in the group sales department that they've seen. I mean, he's really good at it. He talks to I think of Saul Goodman. I think of him. And, but now they want him to not just, enter his sales into the computer, which he can do, but to create spreadsheets and, data dumps and I don't know, to create, enough data for them to crunch the numbers and to come up with plans. You know, he needs to.
He needs to up his game.
Yeah, exactly.
And he doesn't want to.
No, he's like, I'm sorry, I'm a salesperson. I talk to older people and get them to go to concerts. I go out and I give presentations. I'm not a computer geek. I'm not a data nerd. I'm not going to sit down and create Excel spreadsheets and data-driven plans for, you know, my job. If you want someone else to do that, you can get someone else to do that, but I'm not going to. And I'll just say this. It is a source of conflict for him. And it is a, you know, and I guess in 40 years, when the next round of, you know, retirement home patrons are being courted, they will be courted probably on their smartphones and not by, you know, a nice guy in a tie going to their retirement home and giving a presentation.
I'll tell you what kind of geek I am. When you said he reminds me of Saul Goodman, mm-hmm. I thought, no, he reminds you of Jimmy McGill.
You're right. He reminds me of Jimmy McGill. Yes.
People who are going to be, you know, in their golden years, courted, those who have any money left, will be courted via their smartphones, will be using smartphones, and their use of smartphones will certainly set them apart from everybody else who has long since moved on to, you know, some newer platform.
Right. Yeah. They'll be using, you know, not the smartphones we have now, but something that comes out in the next 20 years. But by the time they are, you know, in the retirement home, it will be terribly antiquated. It's like, sort of like being on Facebook today.
And I've certainly curtailed my time spent on Facebook.
The young people aren't, I understand, young people don't go to Facebook now. And I'm not sure, they're on pictureofmyfood.com, or I'm not sure. There's some other, you know, less substantial site than Facebook that they are drawn to. One where, like, I guess maybe there's just a flash of light on the screen.
It means something to them, but not to you.
Triggers some dopamine release, and they're like, and, you know, their friends set up different murals for them. You know, I'm not sure. But, yeah, kids are not interested in Facebook now.
Well, my youngest has a Facebook account. I'm looking at his wall now. His most recent public post was June 17th, 2017.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep. And my oldest does not have a Facebook account, and as far as I know, spends most of his time online on Discord.
On Discord. And so, okay, yeah. Now, that's kind of like a better version of Skype, right?
As far as I understand it.
Yeah. And so that means he's not collecting thousands of followers or friends
no.
from around the world. I mean, he probably is collecting friends from around the world through gaming, and they talk on Discord.
Yeah, he's not a huge gamer, I don't think. I think it's more of they call their discussion groups or whatever servers there, and he's sort of a junior admin on one of them, and they make podcasts and videos for each other, but they don't post them publicly. And this is what I've pieced together through, you know, his stonewalling of my questions.
Oh.
But I know when I'm with him, he wants to be on Discord all day, like, you know, locked away in a room somewhere. And he's just jonesing for it when I make him come out and interact with people and eat food and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I have a 15-year-old son. I've got three sons, my three sons, and a daughter. But the sons, my sons are the ones who, each one of them have gone through a phase where most of the time when I would talk to them, they would have a gaming headset on, and they would be talking to someone else at the same time as me, either on Skype or on Discord or something. So they'd come in, and I would say, hey, time for dinner, or you want to go for a walk, or we're going to watch a movie. And it'd be like, and I would actually hear like five people respond to me through his speakers. Or actually, that's not exactly right. He would then have to tell people, oh yeah, that's my dad. So it's a strange world. And the smell of teenage sweat in a room that's been closed for far too long is
I think it was How to Get Ahead in Advertising, a movie from like the late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah.
Where there was a very powerful character. You know, people would come to see him in his office, and he'd be sitting behind a desk, and he'd have a headset on, and he'd be talking to somebody else while he was talking to the person who was on screen with him.
Right.
And that was, you know, super high status behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not something that any normal person that you might meet in the real world would do. They wouldn't have access to that, you know, and they wouldn't have the confidence or the arrogance, you know, to think that that would be acceptable behavior. You know, it was kind of like watching, Network?
It was the way he humiliated people.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, you know, you would think he was talking to you, but he would be talking to someone in Beijing or something.
Or he'd be talking to them about you. And not hiding
terrible.
It.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it reminds me of the movie Network, which, you know, at the time was supposed to, it was a satire. But if you watch it now, it's so cute. You know, it's so cute that they're in the 1970s thinking just how absurd media could get is so pale compared to what it's actually become.
Yeah, I should watch it again. It doesn't work quite as satire now.
No, it's definitely a historical document of some kind.
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah. Although I don't know, the media now is strange because, like, I think the mass media has degraded quite a lot. Like television is split. Yeah, the television is split. It's like there's great, you know, golden age TV shows that are highly produced and like little films, and they're probably better than what Hollywood's producing. And then there's daytime TV, and there's The View and all that stuff, which I don't really know much about, actually. I'm out of it. But and there's reality TV. And, you know, all of that stuff looks horrible, you know, even worse than what's on network. But all these niche programs on TV and then also on the internet seem better than ever. And you can find really interesting kind of highbrow material online fairly easily. And it's sort of all indistinguishable now. You know, the difference between a mainstream news program and something released by some group of sectarian Marxists somewhere, say. So I don't know. I kind of feel like we're in a very strange time in terms of media. And the idea that these kids are making podcasts and video shows for each other and not releasing it to the public, that's really interesting to me because it's I'm not sure. When I was a kid, I would want to get an audience if I was making that kind of thing. I would be very drawn.
Right. You would hope that one of your zines would somehow circulate through the world to somebody who would find it and say, hey, I want more of this, and I have the means to to distribute it.
Now distribution is something you're trying to avoid.
Well, not me.
Well, I mean, these kids, because they're not looking for a living, right? So, and they're trying to have these conversations for themselves, and distribution is something that happens to them rather than something they seek after. It's like, oh, a tweet goes viral when you didn't intend it to, and it ruins your life or wrecks your future.
Right. And you and I would probably like our sons to be giving some thought about doing something that would generate some income.
Yeah.
At least I would.
Yes, that's true. Well, I mean, I am not so concerned about my oldest son, because he's a math major at the U of O. She's doing all right, and he's going to be doing stuff. But my teenagers, yeah, it's a balancing act to try not to turn into, you know, the authoritarian and say, clean your room.
Yep.
That's right.
Well, they have Jordan Peterson for that, so. You know, you're talking about the transformation of the mainstream media. Another aspect of it that strikes me is the dishonesty and the denial going on. Like, you know, Bill O'Reilly's gone now. He's not on Fox, at least anymore. But, you know, he could say something outrageous, and it would be news that NPR would cover. But if you really look at the size of Bill O'Reilly's audience and the size of Joe Rogan's audience, Bill O'Reilly is nobody. He's nobody. He's talking to people who have one foot in the grave, and there's not even that many of them watching. And, you know, he's a sideshow. He's, you know, filigree. But
at his peak, was he nobody? I mean,
well, at his peak,
how many people,
you know, before the market fragmented so much? Yeah, he wasn't nobody. He was somebody. Mm-hmm. But now he's nobody compared to Joe Rogan. And yet you will never hear a story on NPR about Joe Rogan.
That's true.
You know, but if the size of the audience had anything to do with the relevance of his media production, you would hear stories about him all the time.
Well, he was recently in the New York Times. They're catching on that there's this thing called the intellectual dark web. And Joe Rogan's at the center of it, which is kind of crazy.
How is it crazy to you? Why does that seem crazy?
Well, Joe Rogan is a comedian. He does a chat show. And he has all sorts of different people on, and he's not really an ideological guy, and he's not really an intellectual. He's sort of, someone said, Joe Rogan is Oprah for men. I kind of think that's that might be right. He's an entertainer. And it's not like he's Alex Jones or someone, you know, and not that.
He's a friend of Alex Jones.
He's friendly with Alex Jones, sure, but they're not. I don't think they're really on the same page. I just don't think of Joe Rogan like if he was coming up 30 years ago, he'd have a daytime talk show.
Except he wouldn't, because he wouldn't make it past the gatekeepers one.
But maybe he wouldn't. Yeah, maybe he wouldn't. Right, but he could have had a successful daytime.
The thing that's absurd to me about saying that Joe Rogan is at the center of the intellectual dark web is that, to me, when you say dark web, That's something that you get a Tor browser and, you know, you take steps to cover your tracks and assure right. your anonymity more than just, you know, creating a pseudonym. I mean, it's seriously not the publicly accessible web. And to say, you know, intellectual dark web just means to say something which is foreign to my Gen X or, you know, late baby boomer sensibilities. It doesn't really have anything to do with what, you know, the phrase the dark web means.
No, it was something that Eric Weinstein, you know, cooked up as a branding exercise. It doesn't really mean anything, but it doesn't refer, you know, it refers to a bunch of I would call it the anti-social justice warrior industry. And that I think is more accurate than intellectual dark web.
Let me eat Tumblr. All right. Hey, we've been on for 55 minutes, and I want to get to this AI will spell the end of capitalism article.
Oh, okay.
So Kevin D., mm-hmm. whom I have met, if it's the same Kevin D. I'm thinking of, I've met in real life, and he's into Thomas Ligotti, and I had him on the podcast a couple of years ago. We did at least one episode, maybe two, on Thomas Ligotti.
Yes. I know him well. Yeah. I met him. He came here. He's actually stayed in my house. And he visited once before. He was the first person ever told me about 4chan.
Okay, so
a long time ago.
a friend of both shows, in more than a superficial passing sense. And so he sent us both this link to an editorial on the Washington Post, and it's AI will spell the end of capitalism.
Right, I'm looking up right now. I have read it, but I just thought I'd bring it up on the screen here.
The author is Feng, and I don't know how to say the last name. Might be saying the first name wrong, but it's Feng Xiang.
I'm going to say Feng Shang, but I'm just okay. going to say that. I'm not sure that's right.
No, we're throwing darts in the dark here.
But he's
a professor of law at Tsinghua University and is one of China's most prominent legal scholars.
Okay.
And so he is arguing that in the past, centrally planned economies failed because there's just too many variables for human minds to take into account. And if you try to direct everything from the top that way, it just won't work. But now that we have AI, AI can handle far more of those variables than humans can, and it can work. And what's more, now that AI is becoming enmeshed in every part of our daily lives, it is becoming far too powerful to be left in the hands of private enterprise. So it needs to be nationalized.
Mm.
And I wasn't terribly impressed by those arguments. I wasn't even aware the first time that I read through it what this gentleman's qualifications were or, you know, what entities he was representing. I was just taking the arguments at face value. And it just seemed to me that this was being written by somebody who thought that, you know, state communism was something that was workable before AI. And so, you know, bringing AI into it is kind of a red herring.
Right. I don't hold with the idea that centralized planning alone will overturn capitalist production. And so nationalizing an AI in an effort to rationally distribute everything in a capitalist economy, from the perspective of my book, you know, if you're living in the world of bash revolution, well, just bring the nuclear Armageddon faster. You know, you're rationalizing an irrational system, so you're streamlining and making an irrational system more efficient. And so I don't agree with his. I mean, as to inside capitalism, whether it's better to nationalize AI or to leave it in private hands, this is the kind of debate that I'm not that interested in. But I mean, I'm not sure that it's, you know, well, for instance, in my book, it's a state-owned AI, right, that takes over. So I don't think the AI, that whatever threats we get from a truly conscious artificial intelligence would be in any way mitigated by putting it in the control of the state. But more than that, it just as a the headline saying that the AI is going to end capitalism is really interesting to me, because that's sort of what happens in Batch Batch Revolution, only not in any way like this author spells out.
Well, you know, the title again is AI Will Spell the End of Capitalism, which to me, you know, it sounds like it's one of these historical inevitability things. Doesn't require any particular policy change, because it's going to happen. But then you get into the article, and I want to read four short paragraphs from the middle of the article.
Yeah.
He writes, "The more AI advances into general-purpose technology that permeates every corner of life, the less sense it makes to allow it to remain in private hands that serve the interests of the few instead of the many. More than anything else, the inevitability of mass unemployment and the demand for universal welfare will drive the idea of socializing or nationalizing AI. Marx's dictum, from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs, needs an update for the 21st century. From the inability of an AI economy to provide jobs and a living wage for all, to each according to his needs. Even at this early stage, the idea that digital capitalism will somehow make social welfare a priority has already been proven a fairy tale. The billionaires of Google and Apple, who have been depositing company profits in offshore havens to avoid taxation, are hardly paragons of social responsibility. The ongoing scandal around Facebook's business model, which puts profitability above responsible citizenship, is yet another example of how, in digital capitalism, private companies only look after their own interests at the expense of the rest of society." So I thought that was the strongest part of the whole article. What's your response to that?
Okay, well, first of all, in my book, the Marx's dictum is rewritten as well, and it goes from each according to their abilities to each according to their demographic profile and score.
Which is actually something the Chinese Communist Party is putting into effect.
So
you know about their social score, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't mean like, you know, social score. It was their, you know, collected score on the various games that they've played. But actually, I don't even think and score is part of it. It's just from each according to their ability to each according to their demographic profile and favorite movie selection, I think is what it was. So, in other words, to their need, to, you know, to match their desires more than their needs. And he is assuming he needs to read Critique of the Gotha Program. He's assuming that
he needs to read what?
The Critique of the Gotha Program that Marx wrote.
Okay.
A ways back, because Marx rails against socialists who believe that redistribution alone will bring on a socialist society, that you can just redistribute the commodities produced under capitalism and voila, have socialism. Marx believes that you have to change the mode of production and not just the way that we distribute the goods produced by a capitalist mode of production.
Is there another way to say mode of production? Because there's a surly 19-year-old in me that when I hear that piece of jargon, my eyes just glaze over. I'm like, blah, blah,
sure.
Blah.
Okay, so right now, let me see if I can think of a better way to put it. So right now, we produce things in order to create a surplus of value and to create profits. So the aim of our production is to create actually, an abstract. See, I'm not. It's getting worse, not better. But an abstract value in society, and to maximize how many people are working and how many hours are being worked, and how much is being produced. So, to change the mode of production, I should say, the aim of our productive work. To change the aim of our productive work, rather than to simply redistribute the goods that come out of that productive work. So if we go to work to produce goods, not in order to create profits, but in order to, you know, make the possibility of continued gameplay possible, and to send that, that will already change the distribution. So it will break the capitalist production. I can't not use the terms. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I will work on this. I will create a video that will translate all this Marx speak into everyday language. And then in the future, I can be confident in using layman's terms for these economic categories. But the point is that right now we produce commodities to sell on the, in the market in order to create profits, and those profits come from the fact that we exploit labor and the time of workers, and so that's the Marxist theory anyway. And this guy who quotes Marx in his article should know all that. And if you believe that, then you can't think that continuing to exploit workers for wage and, you know, have a wage-based economy based on exploitation will be socialist. You have to realize that you can't have a class of people who, you know, have to work to survive for other people and have a socialist economy. Is that better? Is that clearer?
No. It might be when I listen to it the second time in the editing.
Okay. Anyway, he needs to read the Critique of the Gotha Program. He's not Marxist enough. Bah humbug.
This part's definitely going in the vault. So. On the main podcast, if you have anything else to say about artificial intelligence and the end of capitalism, I will put that in the main podcast.
Well, I think that for me, the most important thing about Bash Revolution is that it is a way to think about the problems that we're facing, at, you know, as a society around, you know, like Trump and foreign policy and the sense that society is sort of running off the rails without becoming hysterical and without falling into moralism. And, you know, there's a little thought of experiment in there is about around the idea of what it would take to change from capitalism into some other kind of society. And the vision that it presents isn't necessarily a utopian one or one that's, you know, particularly palatable, especially if you're not a gamer, but it is a vision, and I think it's successful in terms of achieving that aim of sort of doing a thought experiment around what it would take to break from capitalism. And also, it's fun. I like Matthew Munson. I like Jeffrey Munson. It was fun to write those characters.
It was fun to read them. Yeah. For me, though, a future which involves me, for the most part, not actually seeing and experiencing what's around me and instead being enmeshed in, you know, artificial representations of different environments and non-player characters. No matter how good the game, there's definitely an element of dystopia there.
Right.
And then the real dystopia hits when that system falls apart and people who have been living in coddled, you know, augmented reality for years are suddenly called upon to do some productive work to fend for themselves and provide for their families and, you know, make functioning communities.
Right. I mean, this might be a topic that we could talk about for in the vault because it's one that we've been kicking back and forth for years. I tend to be more optimistic and also kind of more positive about the way capitalism brings people together to create complex systems of shared work and distribute goods and sort of it undermines local self-reliance. I'm okay with all of that. I feel like the socialist vision I have would include the kind of modern experience of living in a highly artificial space where humans have created systems to control their environment and where, you know, what's happening in Beijing is as important to you on your, on a daily level as what's happening, you know, 20 miles down the road. I'm just fine with all that. I mean, I know that there's problems because of blah, 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 environmental destruction and running out of oil. Okay. We'll fix that. We'll harvest energy from the sun and genetic engineering will fix all the environmental problems and we'll get a Hoover to clean the air or something. I don't know. But but the point is like I have a techno-utopian vision and where I didn't like I think 8 years ago really. I'm more aligned with techno-utopianism now. So
you're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host KMO.
That was Douglas Lane, and we were talking about his most recent novel, Bash Bash Revolution. And toward the end there, we were talking about an editorial that ran in a variety of places. I read it in the Washington Post, called AI Will Spell the End of Capitalism, published by a renowned legal scholar in China, someone who is definitely friendly to Marxism. And those of you who have heard a lot of episodes of me talking to Doug, largely on the Sea Realm Vault podcast, know that I was kind of playing a bit of a character there at the end. I at least understand the basic principles of Marxism. I don't need quite as much hand-holding and spoon-feeding as I was pretending there at the end. But the point stands that Marxism has accreted this exoskeleton of jargon, which has become inseparable from it, and which is really off-putting to people who are not versed in the jargon. And there are some ideas there that should probably be reframed in a jargon-free way, because until they are largely off the table for mainstream consideration. And while I'm not a Marxist, I'm also not a reflexive anti-Marxist. And in deciding how to reformulate our society, which I think will be necessary in the near future, the corpus of Marxist thought probably has something useful to contribute. Now, that's not to say that the shape that our society will take in the coming years or after its coming transformation will have anything to do with any sort of consensus that we come to via discussion on social media and podcasts and such. There is just no telling. Okay, hopefully in the editing I've gotten rid of all the buzzes and beeps from my cell phone and meows from the cat. I've turned the phone off. The cat, I've yet to find her off switch. She has been fed, she has been groomed, I have played with her. I don't know what else she wants from me. Just to be heard, I guess. I can understand that, that's why I keep doing these podcasts. As you could probably tell from the editing of my conversation with Doug, there's a lot more to this conversation than what you've heard in this episode of the Sea Realm podcast. In fact, there is a whole nother hour to it, which Sea Realm Vault subscribers will be able to hear later today. You probably know that the Sea Realm Vault podcast is a second podcast that I do. It comes out more often than this main Sea Realm podcast. And you can subscribe to it by going to my Patreon page. That's patreon.com/KMO. Just three capital letters, KMO. You can also get there from my website. It's www.crealm.com. That's the letter C and then a dash and then R-E-A-L-M, crealm.com. You know what I'm going to say next, right? My email address is kmo@crealm.com. There is no contact link on my website. I'm really only interested in hearing from people who listen to the podcast and who know that my email address is kmo@crealm.com. Thank you to everybody who subscribes to the Sea Realm Vault podcast, either at the old $8 monthly subscription rate or at the new discounted $7 rate through Patreon. Thanks also to those people who support me on Patreon at just the $1 a month level. It doesn't get you access to the Sea Realm Vault podcast, but it does get you behind-the-scenes glimpses into the production of the comic strip, the weekly comic strip, of which I am the illustrator and co-author. It's called Terra Inferma, and you can find it on the cfpup.org website. CFPUP stands for Center for Progressive Urban Politics. If you are into webcomics, I hope you'll check it out. All right, that's all for this episode. Thanks so much for listening. If you are a Sea Realm Vault subscriber, you will get a second podcast from me today. Promise. That will be the continuation and conclusion of my most recent conversation with Doug Lane. All right, I'm out. Stay well.